smiling because I'm just wondering whether I should say this, but I'm just going to say it. Every time I come into a hall and everybody's there and waiting, I'm reminded of what one of my teachers said, and he's not a Zen teacher. When he'd come into the hall and we were all waiting, he'd kind of say, "What are you waiting for? Why aren't you practicing?" And I find myself being on this side in the hall and thinking, yeah, I appreciate what you said in those days. Didn't get it then, but get it now. In that spirit. So this afternoon, I'd like to offer some reflections on how we might consider our meditation practice as a process whereby we learn to mind the gap, to mind the gap, and how that gap might be experienced, not so much understood, but experienced as a space that is empty in the way that Bernard was sharing this morning, a space for potential healing even, and transformation. And that if we practice in that way, minding the gap, creating an empty space, it is not merely something that could be considered to be in the service of our own individual well-being, but actually becomes a practice for what I have begun thinking of service in the greater good, service for the greater good. And I would like to frame these reflections within a personal anecdote that actually was the inspiration for these reflections and that I'm hoping will illustrate more concretely what it is that I'm talking about. And I do have the permission of the person involved to share this. And this is the story. It's a New Year's evening many, many years ago in my home, and we are with a group of friends. We're sitting around the dinner table, and as on the New Year's evening, most of us, we do a kind of a go-around. What is the resolution? What is your New Year's resolution? And it came to one of the friends, and he said, "I want to learn to mind the gap in the coming year." He went on to describe what this meant for him by saying that he wants to make a real effort to be less reactive in his life. He wants to make a real effort to be less reactive in his life. And those were his words, minding the gap so that I'm less reactive. And he wasn't talking Buddhism or Buddhist practice. He wanted to learn how to mind the gap, how to create a space between his body, heart, mind receiving an impulse, regardless of where that impulse came from, regardless of what the impulse was, and his reaction to this. Or in other words, creating a space between any one or more of his senses making contact with an object, any object from anywhere, and his reaction to this. Reaction, reactivity. We had Bernard talk about that this morning as well. And as my friend went on to describe how he came to this resolution, wanting to mind the gap in the coming year, there were a couple of things that struck me as particularly poignant that I could relate to. Firstly, he had become aware that over a certain period of time in his life, his reactivity, his words, not mine, his reactivity had morphed into what he described as a default way of being. In other words, it had become a habit. Secondly, he had begun to recognize that more often than not, this habit actually caused him a lot of distress, a lot of dis-ease, left him feeling disconnected, disorientated, dissatisfied, and often downright unhappy. Thirdly, he had begun to acknowledge that his reactivity not only caused himself suffering, distress, dis-ease, but had in fact also caused suffering to those around him, and had in fact harmed some of his more significant relationships. And finally, he was beginning to understand and see more clearly that a lot of the time, what actually lay beneath or what motivated his reactivity was a wanting to control a situation that very often felt beyond his control. When there was fear, when there was anxiety, when there was confusion at any given moment. And the words he used were, "I didn't know better, but now I do." And as he spoke, I found myself thinking that this was very similar to what I'm trying to do in my meditation practice, but I might call it, rather than minding the gap, creating a space. Creating a space. And what I mean with space here is something that is uncluttered, something that is empty. This is also something that Bernard spoke about this morning in the instructions, creating an empty space. A space that is open and that can potentially hold anything and everything, and also, and this is a clue for me, allows for movement, allows for a flow, as opposed to a constriction or a tightness or a limitation, where little of that is possible. In other words, space as a container, if you like, that allows for something to unfold, that allows for something to be revealed, to be seen that which is already present and realized, as opposed to a contraction or an obstruction in which little of anything is possible, let alone flow. And some of the things, just to quickly name them, that can clutter the space, certainly in my experience, views, opinions, habits, judgments, assumptions, and also not recognizing what the Buddha spoke and described in terms of the three marks of existence: anicca, impermanence, dukkha, suffering, distress, dissatisfaction, or and anatta, not self. And I'll say a little bit more about that as I go on. And by means of unpacking my friend's New Year's resolution, I thought I'd like to look a little bit closer at the kind of effort that he might have been talking about. And these are my own words. But he did say, "I want to make a real effort." What could that mean in my practice? How could I relate to that in my Buddhist framework? And to begin with, of course, a recognition, appreciation that for most of us, we do in fact need to make some measure of effort. It does require a staying power for most of us. But instead of possibly thinking of effort in terms of having to make a staunch effort with that kind of energy and that tension, perhaps we could reword it and bring it into its verb form, efforting. To effort, efforting. Or we might consider effort in terms of an energy or even an enthusiasm that we might bring to a situation or to a task or to something that we are trying to cultivate and develop. And certainly, thinking of my friend, I have to make a real effort. That effort also required a certain measure of courage, a certain measure of courage and trust in his potential to do it. And of course, in the Buddhist teachings, there is that term in Pali, virya, effort. It's one of those Pali terms found in various lists that Buddhism is so famous for: the five spiritual powers, the 10 paramis, the eightfold path, and so on. We find virya popping up again and again and again. And in the context of effort, as we find it in the Eightfold Path, it is described in terms of right, or I prefer, appropriate effort. An effort that is needed to learning or to developing or to refine a new task or a skill, honing, refining, developing, learning a new skill. And it's a particular kind of energy or particular kind of effort that we need to bring to the task. Not too much and not too little. A balanced effort. And of course we find that balanced effort in that beautiful Taoist expression, wu wai, effortless effort, action and inaction. The image that Buddha gave, and I'm sure many of you will be familiar with this, of course, is that of a string instrument when talking about effort. A string instrument. A string instrument that is designed to produce a clear and resonant sound. But of course, in order for this potential to be realized, the strings need to hold just the right amount of tension to produce that sound. Too much tension and the strings will snap, and too little tension and the sound will be flat and dull, without any vibrations, without any resonance. And this is a clue for me, this word resonance or resonant. It's a vital quality for me. Resonance as a quality that reverberates, that radiates outward, is a relational quality. It's not an individual quality. It's something that can touch, that can connect. It's something that we can be touched by, as opposed to a dull, flat thud of a sound that doesn't travel anywhere, that doesn't go anywhere, and that certainly can't touch us, or we can't touch others by making that sound. So an appropriate effort here, for me, is one that resonates outwards, one that relates to other, as opposed to an effort that is merely in the service of the individual self. For me, some additional qualities that I would like to consider or like to bring into this way of thinking in terms of appropriate effort or the energy that we want to bring to practice in the service of the greater good are balance, steadiness, and stillness. Balance, steadiness, and stillness. And the image that for me speaks to this the clearest, of course, is that of a seesaw, where there is a midpoint, the pivot, a place of balance, that potential for steadiness in the middle, stillness in the middle, while at the same time, exactly the point around which movement takes place, if the weight on either side of that board are equal, then it's possible for there to be movement at that place of stillness, the pivot around which movement takes place. So steadiness and stillness as the place that allows for movement, or in my language I might say that allow for a response, for an engagement. And here a lovely quote that speaks to this: in order to move the world, we must be able to stand still in it. Tibetan teacher Yongi Mingyur Rinpoche. The thing with effort is like with all phenomena, it too is conditioned. Conditioned by the person we are, the history we bring, our experiences of the past, our capacity, our limitations from one moment to the next, and conditioned also, of course, by the task or the process itself, that which we are engaging in, the level of skill or the kind of skill that is needed to engage the task or to engage the situation. In other words, if it is not a thing, if it is not fixed, if it isn't rigid, it's not static, but rather is something that I might consider as a process and is ongoing, that can, and I might suggest even must, be tweaked and adjusted from time to time to meet the changing conditions we find ourselves in from any moment to the next, whether they're inner conditions or outer conditions. As you might find you have already done throughout the course of the day, and as we will continue to do, tweaking the effort according to the conditions, sometimes less, sometimes more effort. So, looking a little bit closer at what constitutes appropriate effort, as we find in the Eightfold Path. And what is described here is the process of discerning, discerning kusala, or wholesome, skillful states of body, heart, mind, from akusala, or not wholesome states of body, heart, and mind. The Pali word kusala, is one of those words very difficult to translate into the English language. Skillful, wholesome, leading to a sense of ease and contentment. Again, Bernard spoke about the quality of ease this morning as well. Kusala is something that essentially will bring about a good ending. As opposed to akusala, the opposite, where the prefix of a, we might know, means not, as in anatta, not self, and here in this context, not wholesome, not skillful, not ease, and essentially not leading to a happy ending, akusala. At the core of not wholesome states are what are very often referred to as root poisons, greed, aversion, and confusion, akusala mula, root, the root of not wholesome states. And therefore, by default, that which is wholesome, non-greed, non-aversion, non-confusion. What this means to me is that whenever I am driven or motivated or informed by, in terms of body, heart, and mind, by any one of these poisons in any combination, it is likely to give rise to not wholesome states of body, heart, and mind. Whereas when they are not dominant, they might be present in the background, but they are not overwhelming, this is likely to give rise to wholesome states of body, heart, and mind. And this is the process that I feel my friend described so beautifully in his New Year's resolution, without using any Buddhist-y terms, but talking from within his own experience and from the own understanding that he gained into those patterns of behavior that did not in fact lead to a good outcome for himself personally, nor for others around him. And this, I feel, is the important bit. In addition, he had also understood that what often underlay his reactivity, as he called it, these reactive patterns, what gave rise to these, was more often than not an overwhelming wanting or not wanting. Wanting this, not wanting that. Grasping or aversion. We could also say that he wanted things to be different. He wanted things to be other than what they were. Anything but this. And that is, of course, what causes dukkha. That is what causes anxiety, distress, dissatisfaction, dis-ease. When we are so caught up in our cycles of reactivity that we cannot see what I would call the wood for the trees, we become so completely oblivious to anicca, to impermanence, as in fact the only certainty there is, that when all is said and done, the bottom line, the only thing that we can rely on, that we can truly know, is a certainty of change and impermanence. Everything that arises, everything that has arisen, will change, will become otherwise, and will cease to be. And included in that, of course, is this particular body, heart, mind. This too has arisen. This too is changing, is becoming otherwise, and this too will cease to be. And it's with all the compassion we can muster at any given moment that we recognize and we create space for the fear, for the confusion, for the despair that arises in the face of anicca. Of course, of course. And simultaneously, Can we be willing to open and widen that experience in the face of anicca, in the face of my own impermanence, so that we may begin to realize our human capacity to not only be overwhelmed in the face of anicca, but also to open up to embrace, dare I say, those dimensions of experience that speak of the tenderness of heart, the poignancy of our lives. And in creating space for this perspective, the poignancy, the tenderness, we also create space, I feel, for that which is not despairing in the face of anicca, not anxious, not only overwhelmed, but rather that which can be steady and still and compassionate and wise in the midst of turmoil. In the midst of turmoil, be that inner turmoil or outer turmoil, be that our own turmoil or the turmoil of other. And the more we are able to do this with our own personal experience of turmoil, of overwhelm, the more we will resonate with that which is beyond the personal. Not minding the gap can become a default behavior, as my friend described, and it can indeed morph into a habit, a cycle of reactivity. And the problem with this, as he shared with us, distress, pain to self and other, a sense of stuckness, a sense where nothing can move, nothing can change or be different, with very little space for anything else, a constriction, a contraction, a rigidity, a tightness. And personally, I would also add that that's not the place conducive for human flourishing. For human flourishing. Reactivity, then, as it relates to not minding the gap, could be considered as that which blocks, or at the very least, that which obstructs flourishing. Reactivity doesn't encourage our own flourishing, our own potential to unfold to the fullest human being each one of us is, nor does it allow for a flourishing of the collective, and that includes all sentient beings as well as the planet. And in a collective, reactivity also can become a habit. When we look at the content of our reactive habits, my reactivity, I might notice how this is by definition always about me, myself, and I, with very little space for other. I want, I don't want. I like, I don't like. Every time I'm caught up in that cycle of reactivity, I inevitably engage a process whereby the sense of myself is fed and perpetuated and consolidated. Reactive habit patterns leave very little, if any, space or room to recognize how our sense of self is constantly being shaped, constantly morphing and impacting by what are the ever-changing conditions of our lives, our personal lives, and of life as a whole. Reactivity does not and cannot recognize self as a process that is in constant flux, organically morphing, but rather something that solidifies our sense of self. And in relation to that, what would it mean to mind the gap? To mind the gap. Minding the gap, as I said just now, is a process for me of creating space. Space in which I open up to, in which I accept and hopefully come to embrace what comes at me, what comes to me, what it is that I'm engaging with, whatever it is, whatever life presents, and however life presents. My life in particular, my personal life, but also life in general, the world as a whole, the bittersweet nature of it all, the both and, That is the essential quality of our experience, always, in every situation. Never just one thing, always both and. And when I talk about accepting, or hopefully even embracing, the bittersweet nature of it all, the totality of my life, the lovely as well as the unlovely, I'm not talking about a state of resignation. I'm not describing a state of disinterest, of dissociation. Quite the opposite, actually. It implies a willingness to show up for all of life and to recognize it as a phenomena that, like all phenomena, is conditional. It has arisen, it will change, and it will pass away. And such a perspective can lead to a recognition, it can lead to recognition to the preciousness, to the value, to the poignancy of life. And I've already spoken to that. For me, minding the gap, or creating a space, a different way of saying that, is a practice of learning to recognize, it's like that. It's like that. What does that feel like? This is what it feels like. And to accept whatever it is in its fullest embrace. And then from within that space of what I might call radical acceptance, then to ask the question, given the situation such as it is, given the conditions of the moment such as they are, right here, right now, how should I respond? For me, those moments when I can do that rather than be overwhelmed by the circumstances of my life, those moments are what I would call tastes of freedom. A taste of freedom. They are moments that offer a larger perspective in which I don't perhaps take myself quite as seriously. A perspective in which others are included. And a perspective that also offers a space in which that appropriate response, a way of engaging, might arise spontaneously. In other words, minding the gap, we create a space that holds the potential for healing and transformation, for change. But of course that means I also need to be aware of that space. I need to be alert to, awake to the gap if I have minded it. I need to remember to pay attention to not only what is going on, being present to what is arising, but also I need to pay attention and be aware of my responses to that which has arisen. Noticing the tendency, noticing the inclination to grasp that which is pleasant, or to push away, to turn away from that which is unpleasant, wanting and not wanting, grasping and aversion, akusala mula, the roots of not wholesome states. And if I am able to mind the gap, there is a space that can be created in which I might just be able to respond, if I am present, to respond in a more wholesome way rather than a not wholesome way. And for me, that's one of the reasons I practice. To remember, or to be reminded more often, of what this is all about. And again, Bernard was also pointing to that this morning, sati, mindfulness, to remember, to be reminded of. For me, it's a particular kind of remembering, not any old remembering, not any old reminder. A reminder to pay attention, not simply for the sake of paying attention, but in order to respond appropriately. And I recently came across a passage by Mary Oliver that I hadn't seen before, and it speaks to this quality of paying attention. And this is what she says. It has frequently been remarked about my own writings that I emphasize the notion of attention. This began simply enough, to see that the way the flicker flies is greatly different from the way the swallow plays in the golden air of summer. It was my pleasure to notice such things. It was a good first step. But later, watching M when she was taking photographs, and watching her in the dark room, and no less, watching the intensity and openness with which she dealt with friends and strangers too, taught me what real attention is about. Attention without feeling, I began to learn, is only a report. An openness and empathy was necessary if the attention was to matter. And when I reflected on this last sentence, if the attention was to matter, for me it reminded me that to matter was creating a space in which I can choose not to react, but to respond and engage differently. In learning to mind the gap, in learning to create empty spaces, we are actually cultivating an ongoing and ever gradually opening and widening of our awareness. And on one level, we can practice this quite consciously, quite actively. And on another, this is something that seems to happen quite on its own, a mystery almost. We don't actually have to do a whole lot, but we have to be alert. We have to be awake to when we are no longer present in this moment. And then we bring the awareness back to that which anchors us in the body, in the present moment, in the way that we've been practicing in the course of today. In practicing steadiness and stillness and opening, we actually begin over time to experience a perspective that is ever wider and more open, a perspective that embraces a whole lot more than we might have initially thought possible or even intended. In slowing down, we might begin to feel less frenetic, less cluttered inwardly, more empty inwardly, and we experience a greater sense of clarity. As time goes by, and as we check into and as we fine-tune the effort of our practice, we might begin to find ourselves beginning to become increasingly alert and awake to the world around us, more connected, more resonant, more responsive. Grounding ourselves in the body, we sit, we stand, we walk, we lie, we calm down body, heart, and mind, and we focus our attention on what arises from one moment to the next. We do very ordinary things, sleeping, eating, brushing our teeth, listening to the sounds of the birds, the surrounding views, and more of the same, day in, day out. And just maybe in the course of today even already, we might have felt ourselves just for a moment or so, just a little bit more steady, just a little bit more open, just a little bit more peaceful than what we did when we arrived yesterday. Over time, we might notice impatience morphing into patience, irritability transforming to kindness, dullness turning to brightness, not wholesome qualities developing quite by themselves, transformed into wholesome qualities. The ordinary begins to become more and more extraordinary, and we start to feel more and more connected to the world around us, to the people we meet, in the situations that we are. We begin to take care, and we begin to notice those times when there is an ever greater sense of ease in body, heart, and mind. We practice and we continue with minding the gap, creating an empty space, creating ever longer spaces between our habits, whatever they might be, and our reactivity. And we begin to feel, in time, moment by moment, less manipulated, less controlled, less overwhelmed by the preoccupations of the ego. We begin to taste, or we begin to have a taste every now and again, what it might be like to be free from dukkha. Those momentary experiences of not being caught up in our habitual cycles of reactivity. Many of us, I know I do, have a default setting of noticing when things don't go well, when we feel discouraged, when nothing seems to be going on, when I'm bored, when I'm distracted, and I'm asking what's the point of it all. But do we pay equal attention to those moments when things are going well? When we do feel steady, when we do feel open, when we realize that there has been a shift in the heart. When there is joy, when there is freedom from that which constricts and closes and obstructs. Do we acknowledge those moments as moments of freedom, as the realization of our potential for transformation, for healing, for freedom? So important, those moments, so very important to see them for what they are, because they in turn generate the trust, the courage that is such an important and vital quality in the practice, sustaining the practice, a trust in our potential, the courage to show up, the trust in the practice, the faith in the practice, which is why we're all sitting here. Do we remember that? So I've spoken about minding the gap as a process in which we open to a space that holds the potential for creativity, for healing, for transformation, where kindness and joy, compassion, wisdom may arise spontaneously, when we let go of fixed views, judgments, and opinions, when we take back projections, when we suspend judgments, when the ego is more contained, when we are no longer held captive by our cycles of reactivity. There is freedom in those moments when we are aware of, when we experiencing the ungrasping where we might have grasped, when we experience and are awake to those moments when we have turned towards something rather than habitually turning away. And is this not, I would suggest, is this not what is described in the third of the four truths? There is an end to dukkha. There is an end to suffering. Or to use words from a slightly more secular approach, there is an end to reactivity. And I would say that given the state of the world we find ourselves in, that is not an insignificant contribution that each one of us can make to the world. To end off with a quote I'm sure many of you are familiar with by Viktor Frankl, the Austrian neuropsychologist, who said this: between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. So much for minding the gap. Thank you for your attention, for your listening. Just a moment to let the words settle.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.